I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Welcome to Spark My Muse, everybody. Today, my guest is Anne Bogle. She is multi-talented. She has Modern Mrs. Darcy, her blog, which makes her a tastemaker with book lists and reading guides, and also the fantastic What Should I Read Next podcast, also in its 100th episode, where she tells people what they should read next based on their preferences and reading habits. And now she has a new book called Reading People, How Seeing the World Through the Lens of Personality Changes Everything. And thank you for being on my show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So as we get started, for people who don't know who you are at all, maybe you can talk a little bit about how you got started with your blog and how that developed.
I'd be happy to. It was something I did not see coming. Mm-hmm. My husband and I were sitting around New Year's time in like 2010, 2011. But it was right around New Year's, and the kids were in bed, and we had takeout sushi and a bottle of wine. And we were talking about the year that had gone by and what we wanted to do in the year ahead. And my husband had done a little bit of blogging for business the year before. And we were talking about that. Like, I was saying, What did you think? How did that experiment play out? You seem to enjoy it. You should do it some more. And he was like, yeah. But I've been thinking, and you know who I think should really start a blog? And I was like, no, who? And he said, you should. Like, you'd be perfect for this. I was like, you are out of your mind. Like, the only blog I read is yours. What are you talking about? So I'm swayable. And 15 minutes later, we were brainstorming categories and what it could be called. And it was, the first post went live at the end of February 2011. So it took a while to get it together and make it actually happen. Although at the time, it seemed like we were very deliberate and plotting, but really it was less than 2 months. It wasn't super long, but that's where the idea was born.
Tell me why you decided on this particular type of blog.
When people think of a book blog, that's not what I write. And it was never the intention. It's emphatically not a review blog, which is most of what you see online when you look in the books and reading space. I just wanted to write on what was mostly the theme of writing about familiar topics from a slightly unexpected angle so that you could see it in a new way. And I think just because I loved books and reading so much, I would do posts about things I had read. Like, I'd riff an idea that I read about, or I'd share an interesting thought I had after reading a novel. And eventually we put out a summer reading guide, and I started a Best Books You've Never Heard Of series that are not reviews. I prefer to speak to like how a book might change your mind or how a book might make you feel, instead of like, here's the good and here's the bad, and do you want to read it now? So that's not what I've done. But over time, books and reading did become a much bigger part of the blog. And so now I totally get it when people say like, oh, it's a book blog, and it's not, but that's fine.
Well, you have such,
I get it.
The way I found out about you was on Twitter from writers, and they were like, your fans are hardcore and they just love you to death. And that is awesome. When I see that happening, like, oh, do you know Anne? Oh, and they would like share your stuff. And you can really tell when people's fans love going and reading your next thing. And it was really sweet to see that. So that's kind of how I got drawn into your blog, which I hadn't read as much as I had heard about you. Like, I had seen, like, you had a reputation that preceded you, kind of thing. And I thought that that was really cool how you had such a loyal fan base. And it's probably because you had such a unique take on books and connecting with people in a unique way, which is kind of where segueing into the podcast, which has a much more connectional feel than so many podcasts. And maybe you can describe what that is and how it works.
Sure. Well, just like the blog, I think it really attracts people who are reading. And I knew that we had a lot of avid readers in our group. And I don't just mean like people who like to read, I mean, people who read like 24, 50, 100 books a year. So I knew that we had those kinds of readers among us. And I knew that when they landed at What Should I Read Next or Modern Mrs. Darcy, they would feel like they had found their people. But almost as a joke this year in our member survey, and this just happened a couple months ago, we asked readers, because they said, like, wouldn't it be great to know? Like, I'm super curious how many books we really read around here. So in years past, every year we've surveyed people and said, do you read like 0 books a year, 1 to 6, 6 to 12, or more than 24? Like, that's where we stopped it. But this year we asked about 50 to 100, 100 to 200, or 200 or more. I was flabbergasted at the percentage of people who read an insane amount of books, like maybe 70 times the national average. And it really made me realize, like, oh, when they say I feel nobody in my real life understands why I love to read, but I feel like I finally found my fellow readers. Like, now I get it. So on the podcast, we say that it's so good to be among people who are reading. And we do attract people who think there's no such thing as a, what did C.S. Lewis say? How, like, you can never have a book too big or a cup of tea or a book too big. For me, like, we have readers who think I could never have a to-be-read list that is too long. So gluttons for punishment in the best way.
Well, how many books do you think you read in a year?
You know, that's really hard to answer, and I don't track it by number. And I honestly, I know a bunch of people are going to need their smelling salts, but I do not finish anywhere close to the number of books I start. And so I took the numbers out of my journal a long time ago, and I don't put stuff on Goodreads where they will give me like my statistics. So I am really not sure. I bet I finish 100. But I'm really not sure about exact numbers.
Yeah, I also feel like
I'm okay with that.
This is obviously my point of view, and it's like, I'm not even sure who said this, if it was Derek Sivers or someone who said, oh no, it wasn't him, I'm not sure, but who said, you have to earn the right for me to read the whole way through. Like, I can't remember who said that, but in terms of like, you don't have to feel guilty that you didn't finish the book if it didn't keep your attention. And I'm a really fast reader, but I'm more skimming it if it's nonfiction. You know, it's like if really consume quickly, but I also don't have any idea how many books I read a year. And I feel like if I started keeping track, I would almost compete with myself and it would lose something. it would like, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Well, some people are really motivated by that and they think it's fun, but for some people it makes it feel like a chore.
Right, exactly.
So,
yeah, but so you're saying that your audience reads, some people read more than like 500 books in a year?
That's possible, but we have not, we didn't ask about more than 200. So, but like 12% of our people read more than 200 books a year, and I was stunned.
It's a lot.
And they're not reading like Crime and Punishment size books like 5 times a week, but still, like, to finish that many titles is it's a little more than
average. And so for the podcast, then you started thinking about, like, how did this come into your mind about figuring out what people should read next?
Well, the idea actually began as a blog series. And it came out of an idea I'd be batting around in my mind for a long time, just from blogging and being known as someone who reads a lot, who likes to talk about books. Readers would come to me all the time and say, like, oh, I just have a super easy question for you. This will be a piece of cake. I'm looking for a great book to read. And I totally get where they're coming from and why they're asking. Like, their reading life might be a little lackluster these days. Maybe they feel like they're not on a great streak where they haven't liked the last few books they started. Or maybe they just read a story that was amazing and they want to find another one. But I can tell them some books that I thought were fantastic, but that doesn't mean that they are going to love them as well. So I always found myself asking them questions about, well, what are some things that you have loved? What hasn't been to your taste? What are you reading right now? What are some genres you maybe want to read more of? Like, let's find a book that will be great for you. And so one Sunday morning on a whim, I put up a blog post that said, it was called something like literary matchmaking, personal shopping for books, like whatever you want to call it. Let's try something crazy this Sunday morning. And so I said readers could submit and tell me three books they love, one book they hate, and what they're reading now. And I would go in order and make personal recommendations. And so that's what we did for a while. Like every Sunday, I'd answer a few readers' literary matchmaking requests, but it wasn't fun for me. And I wasn't sure how helpful it was for them. Although I did hear from a lot of readers who said, oh my gosh, I love the books. Thank you. Thank you. But I found myself wanting to ask them questions like, ooh, like these books don't go together. Like, why did you like each one? Or what didn't you like about that book? Or would you be willing to try this one title? Or have you read this author before? But you can't do that in the written word. Like, we could email back and forth, but that's just not fun. Like, I would much rather like sit down and discuss it over coffee. So at the same time, I was thinking, oh, podcasting seems fun, but I don't want to do it unless I have a great idea. And after holding these two concepts in my brain side by side for a while, I realized like, oh, wait, this would actually be much better suited to the podcast.
Well, yeah. When I've listened to it, you know, you're asking really interesting questions and people don't sometimes know, you know, they're not even sure why they like something. And then you're asking them and they're really figuring out themselves a little more too. But then you're coming up with things that are, you know, are they okay to be stretched? You know, can you handle something? And so what I was talking about before we started recording here is, how often can you tell that you have made a good pick for?
Well, that's a good question. The only way to know for sure is have them read it and report back. So, but sometimes I will undersell a book. Like I never want people to feel like they're being sold. Like the best I can do is talk about a book in a way that will hopefully communicate why they may or might not like it. But that's tricky sometimes because I found that readers want to read books that I know and that I love. Even though objectively we both know that our tastes are very, very different. Like I could have loved their hate and they could have hated my loves, but still like they want to read a book I'm excited about. So even if I can say like, I think this book is perfect for you, even though I did not like it at all, they won't want to read it. So, and then when they do, usually they do really like it, but that does make it tricky to talk about books in a way that's honest and open. So, I mean, I do talk honest and openly about everything we talk about because there's no other, why wouldn't you, about books and reading? Like, I'm not selling anything. I'm not like, no publishers don't sponsor my show. Like, I'm just talking about it out of love, but, that's not always the case in the books and reading space. But, yeah, it has been interesting to see how much readers want to read what other readers are excited about.
Well, as we shift a little bit toward from reading books to reading people and your new book that's coming out, was that a natural progression? And what was the process for moving toward writing this book?
That actually evolved out of the original idea for the blog, which was, let's talk about familiar topics from a fresh perspective. And over the years since 2011, talking about different personality frameworks has been something I've circled back to periodically over the years, just because I'm a total personality geek. Like, never met a personality test that I didn't want to take, even if it's something like, I don't know, like, what popular seltzer are you? I'm like, oh, this is going to be so dumb, but click, click. I know. Yeah. So I've just really appreciated over the years. Some frameworks help more than others, but I have really appreciated how they give you a language to articulate what's happening in your life and in your relationships, and how they give you fresh eyes to see what's actually happening in the situations you're living in every day, but might not, give a second thought when it would benefit you to do so, or you might not really understand, even though you think you do. So I really liked how, in the same way that a good book can change the way you see the world, a good personality framework can do the same thing. And that had been valuable enough to me that I was really sad when I read about personality and people would say like, oh, I never understood this system. I never understood how this worked, or this has never been useful to me. I think I just don't get it. And this kind of information about these various personality frameworks, like the Enneagram or Myers-Briggs or the love languages or highly sensitive people, had been so valuable to me that felt like such a missed opportunity. So I wanted to write something once I found out that like that accessible book that wasn't written like a psychology textbook, that was actually understandable and immediately applicable, like it didn't exist yet. So is how this book came
to
be.
And I think, some people will take those tests because I've taken them for years, like Myers-Briggs, the official, you know, I don't know, 150 questions or whatever it is, and you know, in grad school and stuff like that. And some people will take them and they'll be like, "That's really not me," and then they kind of throw it all out. And I think it was Ian Michael Crone who does the Enneagram or something like that. I think he said that.
Yeah,
he might have even been quoting someone where he said, "All the tests are false, but they are still useful. Like they're none of them are true. None of them are really accurate, but they're still useful. That it's not like you're going to suddenly find a test that just answers all your questions and all and explains all your connections and all the people in your life and yourself, because we're still so hidden even to ourselves. But that." They're still useful. And one of the things that really helped me, there's also one called the colors test. And it's kind of based on Hippocrates and the four, it's a little bit like the four humors, but was that mm-hmm. I was able to give a lot more grace to people who I would normally just bump into that were very rigid. And I'm very creative and free flowing and flexible. And some people were like, "Nope, there's my way and then the wrong way." And I would always think like, "Are you kidding?" You know, and it helped me tremendously in seeing why someone might be that way and what I could offer in cooperation with them and why I mm-hmm. might, why two of us mm-hmm. might make a good team if there was mutual respect. And so I thought it helped me a lot working with people on projects and stuff. Of course, there has to be mutual respect. There still doesn't help. It still doesn't help. But I've gained a lot from those types of testing and templates too. But there is a lot of mistrust of them sometimes about, are they really accurate? Are they more like, I had to take, this was a terrible thing. I had to take the DISC test. Do you know that one? That's not one mm-hmm. of my more favorite ones because I think it preferences certain ones above other ones in a way. And I had to take this test and I think it came out inaccurately. And the one guy came in, I think he maybe, there was the vice president of the company and he was like, "What do you think about this test? I think it's a fantastic tool." And I should have just been like, "Yeah, me too. Golly, it's great." But I was like, well, I just answered honestly. And I said, "I don't think this particular one is one of the better ones." But he said, "Well, what do you think you scored?" And I don't remember what I said, but he's like, "Nope, you scored this." And I was like, "Okay." And then the next guy who interviewed me right after him said, "It's like a horoscope. You could just say this." The one guy loved me in the interview. The other guy didn't. I didn't get the job because I maybe didn't like the test or scored badly. And I just kept thinking, if they had never tested me with these indicators, I might have had a job there. But I feel like those tests kind of mm-hmm. put a fence around mm-hmm. me. It was really interesting. I think they can be used. They can be weaponized. But as far as what you've done in the book, how do you work through? Do you wind up explaining the different kinds, or do you like walk me through a little bit of what it's like?
Sure. Well, first of all, about the frameworks in general, that's interesting that Cron would say that about them not saying the full truth, but capturing the truth, because that's an Enneagram book that he wrote. And I do really like a quote from Riso and Hudson, who are the men behind the Enneagram Institute, who have a book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram. And they say something like, individuals are only understandable up to a certain point and beyond which we remain mysterious and unpredictable. But even though you can't simply explain any one person, it's still possible to say something that is true about them. And that's what I really like about these frameworks. Like, they don't capture none of it. Like, there is no system that captures the truth about a human being. Like, we're way too complicated. But I do like how they capture something that is true and useful about us. In the book, what I do is I take 7 popular personality frameworks that have been extremely useful to me. In my early draft, Lisa, I had DISC on the list. And when I realized that if we truly want this book to be useful, it cannot be exhaustive. Like, it cannot cover every personality type that has ever been created by anyone anywhere. And so that's when it dropped off the list, when we made the cut, like the ones that I personally have really understood and appreciated and that they've made a difference in my life. So it's true that so many people get their type wrong and then they lose all faith in the system. And I get that. But almost all these tests are self-reporting. So they're only as good as your results. And you have to be really, really honest with yourself to get the right results. And in the book, I talk about how I got my types wrong in several of these frameworks and why I did that and how I learned to actually get my types right. And the short version of that is you have to answer as you really are, not how you wish you could be or think you might be able to become with persistence and effort. Like, you have to answer as you really are, or you're not going to get the right results. And it's not going to be good information. And by good, I mean useful information at all. And all the frameworks in this book, like, there are no right personality types. Like, with the ones that I'm using in the book are ones that are just descriptive of human nature, and they were all value neutral. So even though you might desperately wish you were like the bubbling, outgoing, never met a stranger kind of person, it's not going to help you to say that's your type if that is not you. So that's one of the focuses of the book. But I do take these 7 types and I explain how the framework works, what the types actually mean, how you can figure out where you fall in the spectrum, and then give lots and lots of stories and examples of actual people so you can see the types in action. What I really wanted to do was give the reader an idea of what these frameworks would actually look like in action in their real lives, because there are some people who would enjoy reading about this stuff just because it's fun to learn new information. But for the rest of us, we want something that makes a real difference in our life, that's practical and actionable. And until we understand why knowing about our own personalities and the personalities of those we love or live with or work with, like, why that information will matter, we don't care. So I want the reader to understand how understanding that, say, they're a highly sensitive person will explain why they feel like they are having a meltdown every afternoon at 5:30 when 2 children are talking to them about homework and the dog is barking and the radio is on and there's music playing in the next room and the counters are cluttered and you feel like you're about to lose your ever loving mind and what is wrong with you and can you just like fly to Aruba tonight? But you're highly sensitive. Perhaps take that. Like, you just have a nervous system that's firing at a little higher frequency than the other 80-85% of the population. And once you understand what that means, the difference it makes in your life and what you can do about it, because you can do something about all the information in this book, then it turns that into like this vague sense of unease, or, I mean, where you just don't have any idea what is happening and why, but into something you can actually do something about. Mm-hmm. And that isn't this like massive, huge life issue, but just like a not so hairy problem that can be solved once you know what's actually going on.
Right. It gives some of your suffering meaning and then a way forward.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I've especially found the personality tests that I've been involved with, a few various ones, to be extremely helpful in interpersonal conflicts. That's been really insightful. So like what different people value, or what makes them upset, or what makes them go into a mode of like where they might feel threatened or something like that, and what I can do to make them feel more at ease on my end, what their needs are. Because if you actually know that, you know, it's like having a decoder ring to the person a little bit. And it, what's a little strange is that people do sometimes perform to type, and then that's a little bit weird to realize too.
Yeah, in understanding personality types, and with the examples I give in the book, you can really see how two people acting out of the purest intentions can still fail to misunderstand each other at best, or really hurt each other at worst, even though they're both coming from really good places, just because they see the world differently. And once you understand that that's possible, it's like you've removed this giant blind spot from your way of understanding the world and your relationships. And that's really powerful.
So what is your basic personality type in the Enneagram and the Myers-Briggs?
That's a really personal question, Lisa.
I know.
because the thing about, especially the Enneagram, it's like, hey, stranger, please tell me.
Tell me all your guts.
The worst thing about you. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess that is personal. It's really interesting though, because when I meet someone else that says they're my type, they're my like Myers-Briggs type, I always think, but are they? You know, like, because I wonder if, because we are hidden to ourselves. Like I've mentioned that before. Like I'm thinking, well, if someone were to take this, who observes me, would they get the same letters? Would they figure it out the same way that I have? Or when I take the test, am I afraid, or am I able to see my flaws? Am I blind to them? How blind am I to them? I'm blind to some of them, of course, but if I'm blind to them, then I'm not going to be answering accurately and things like that.
Right, because it is surprisingly difficult to see yourself for who you really are. I did write a book about personality, so I mean, of course I need to be prepared to go there. So on the Enneagram, I am a type 9, mm-hmm. which means I really like people to be happy and not upset all the time. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I really don't like conflict.
That's why you answered the question.
Yeah, and my besetting sin, my weakness is slothfulness or laziness, which I did not understand for a long time because I am not a lazy human being. I get a lot done, but it took me a long time to realize that laziness has to do with personal boundaries and not with like, you know, I'd rather watch TV than do any work today. So, because in one way I'm a little, I need a little motivation. And the other, I do not. Like, I get a lot done. Mm-hmm. So that was really confusing to me for a long time when I was trying to figure out my Enneagram type. And now I have zero doubts about it. And can't believe I ever didn't understand. But I just didn't understand exactly how the system worked and where I fit into it. And now, like, my type 9 doesn't capture everything about me. But it does really help me not get myself into trouble in ways that I used to before I really understood my type and how it's easy for me to go astray in very specific ways because of that type. And then on the Myers-Briggs, I'm an INFP. So I hear what you're saying. Like, you do wonder, would somebody who knows a lot about Myers-Briggs look at me and be able to type me? And the answer is, it really depends, because before I felt like I could really understand Myers-Briggs, I had to get comfortable with the cognitive functions that actually are what the types are getting at. Like the types, those four letter types, like ISTP, INFP, ENFJ, that's just a shorthand for saying which cognitive functions. I know that sounds fancy. It just means like ways of thinking.
Preferences.
Exactly. Which ones I use and then which order. And we all have four that we rely on regularly. There are 8 possible options, but we all rely on 4 in a specific order. And it is that order of operations that determines our type. So for introverts, your main function is introverted, And it means that it's not on display for the world to see. So it can be very difficult to type an introvert by looking at them unless you can hear from them what they're actually thinking. You can't look at them and type them.
Yeah. There's some really interesting thing I learned about introversion that helped me. I married the president of the Introverts Club, basically. And I thought, oh man, I'm such an extrovert. We're so opposite. But I've noticed that I've become more introverted as the years have gone by, and I love connecting with people, but then I have my like 2 or 3 hour limit. My husband probably has a 15 minute limit. But what someone said so astutely was that it's not that introverts don't want to be near people or don't want connection. It's just that their tank fills up very quickly for that. And for extroverts, their tank is much larger and needs to be refilled much more often. And so because I think there's sometimes like, oh, introverts, they prefer to be with them. Don't even bother talking to them because they don't even want to be talked to ever, you know. And while you might hear that from them, it's not that they 100% of the time wish to never be spoken to or connected with in any way, you know. But sometimes you'll get that sense from people who don't understand. And introversion is so misunderstood, as well as extroversion by introverts. Oh, you want to go to a party every night and you want to, you know, it can be very misunderstood. So being able to communicate what those needs are for each type, it can be really helpful.
Yes, that's true. And it is also very true that a lot of people just don't understand what those terms mean or what those people need. So, and when you do understand that, it can make life with the opposite type a lot more pleasant.
Right. Right. Yeah. So let's see, the thing about the Enneagram, when I've taken it, and I've never taken the official test or like the long test, I've taken the little quickie tests that don't cost anything. And I've never been able to get a result that seems accurate, even though my Myers-Briggs seems sort of accurate. And which is interesting because you have more choices with Enneagram. And I would think I was like a 7 with like a 5 and 8 wing or something like that. Now, for people who are listening to this, will be like, I have no idea what you're saying. You're talking gibberish. But it's still, when I read through that, it still sounds like it isn't accurate. And so I would probably need to take a longer test, but maybe I'm just answering poorly. So what would you suggest for if people wanted to begin walking down, besides reading your book, which of course that's number one, but for people who were interested in any one of the personality types or getting into that at all, what do you think are one of the better ones to start out with?
Well, you're right that it can be really hard to determine your type in some of these frameworks. Like, it took me a year to figure out my Enneagram type. It took me many years to get my Myers-Briggs type correct, but that's my own fault. And I go into that in the book. That really is something you could do in an afternoon. It needn't take you years. But for people who want to get like a quick hit of actual life-changing information, I recommend they start with, I think it's chapter 5 in my book about highly sensitive people. A lot of people are not familiar with Elaine Aaron's research, and it either you are highly sensitive or you are not, but the odds of you or someone that you love, live with, work with, neighbor with on a daily basis are very, very good. And it will just change the way that you see the world around you and the people in it. And just to get that, to be able to read 20 pages and learn something new about the world you didn't know before is really, really valuable to me. Just to be able to take in new information and act on it immediately is fantastic when it comes to stuff like this. And that's where I would really recommend starting.
That's good. And I've heard too that children, like the children can't, these are not effective for children. Your personality doesn't really get baked in until you're in your 20s. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes and no. So, I mean, don't try to put a Myers-Briggs type on your toddler, please. But for highly sensitive people, like there are highly sensitive infants. And some people have said, once I understood, like that's what was happening with my 6 week old, it was a game changer. Like, I wish I had known that term when I had a 2 year old who was like screaming about his silk screen shirts because they were too stiff and it made him crazy. Or kids who complain about tags, likely highly sensitive. And understanding that can be amazing. And that is something that stays with you your whole life. And again, that's true across species. So, I mean, it's a human characteristic that is baked in. But other things are not. Like, the Enneagram experts at the Enneagram Institute recommend not trying to figure out your Enneagram type until you are approaching 30, because that type, which is a way of, there are 9 Enneagram types, and what that type number captures is the underlying motivation behind how you approach your life, like what it is you're looking for and why. And those motivations are often unhealthy, which is why sometimes when you hear people say the Enneagram, people who are familiar with it go, oh, they kind of shudder. So right. Richard Rohr says, what does he say? Something like, the truth will set you free, but first it will make you miserable. Like, that's what people yeah. say about the Enneagram. That is something that you don't want to approach until you're older, because it's a system that's designed to be used for fully formed adults. And then some of the other ones are in the middle, like Gary Chapman's love languages. He says that you should try to communicate love to a child with all the love languages, because they're still young and they're not fully formed as people, but that they probably have one or two that they tend to go to more than the others. So you can really use these frameworks as tools to help you think about your behavior and the behavior of others around you. But I mean, this is not gospel truth for approaching the life of a 4 year old, for sure.
Yeah. And I've noticed too, with the love languages, people will often use the love language that they enjoy on you, even if you don't, you know, because that's what they would appreciate. And you're like, why does this person, you know, keep giving me this thing? And you're like, oh, they're a gifts person. They would like gifts or whatever it might be. And, you know, people's behaviors might be motivated. You're not realizing necessarily people's behaviors are motivated in a way that they might feel loved. And to you, they're just doing something strange.
Right. Well, and that's a great example of how you can be operating out of a sincerely thoughtful place and still not have your actions communicate what you want them to, because it totally makes sense where you think like, I want to do something kind for someone. What is the kindest thing I can think of? It's totally normal to think about what you would appreciate. But if you don't know that your way is one of many ways and not the way of expressing love, then you can end up with your message falling short, best case scenario, are really seriously hurt feelings I don't want to say worst case because that sounds awful, but you really can fail to communicate a really important message to people you love.
Yeah. It's like the hugger at church. Like I like hugging people, but I have to really like them, know them, trust them. And then I really enjoy that. But there's, you know, the guy at church who you're not totally sure why he always wants to hug you and everybody else, but it's like the too long hug, you know, like, mm-hmm. okay, you know, mm-hmm. a 2 second hug, but a 7 second hug with the rubbing on the back. No, maybe he likes that for his own love language, but we're not doing that. And it's, I mean, you could really harm relationships or really get people to not trust you when you're thinking, hey, everybody loves hugs like me, right? My graduate work is in spiritual formation. And one of the things that I have really delved into a lot is how much can we transform? How much can we change ourselves with, you know, what kinds of things we do, what kinds of things we think, what kinds of things we say? And that can play into personality and how we interact with others and everything like that. There's some things in our personality that, you know, the sharp edges can maybe get worn off through spiritual disciplines or ways of being. And then there's things that really kind of can't change. And so in your research and what you wrote about, what did you come up with as far as knowing how much can a personality change?
Well, it's interesting, and it depends on what you mean in personality. So in this book, I was investigating 7 personality frameworks that did talk about what you called the baked in traits, like the things that weren't choices or character decisions, but were just like your out of the box model. Like you bought a Honda Accord and this is what comes with it. Like these frameworks look at people in kind of the same way. And your personality does change over time in predictable ways, but not very much. Like over time, we all become a little more introverted and a little more conscientious, usually, statistically speaking. But our character and our behaviors are very susceptible to change. That doesn't mean it's easy to change, but they can be changed, even though that might require great effort on our part. One of my favorite quotes is from Winston Churchill. And the origin story here is after the British House of Commons was bombed, they rebuilt it in a very careful way. They changed the shape. And he said, we create our buildings. And afterwards, no, I think he said we shape our buildings. And afterwards, our buildings shape us. And I think that's a really great quote to talk about our lives as well. Like we create the structures of our lives as people. We get to choose, or at least as adults, we get to choose how we structure our days and who we spend our time with and what we're going to read and who we're going to talk to and what we're going to think about. And those repetitive structures and behaviors change us as human beings. So we can't decide, you know what? I am going to become more extroverted. Like I'm going to be the kind of person who doesn't need to read 100 pages and drink 3 cups of tea to feel like a functioning human being again after spending 5 hours at a cocktail party. Like that we cannot change about ourselves, but we can become more expressively loving, more thoughtful, more kind, more honest. Like those character choices we can do. And our behaviors, we have all kinds of control over. And I think really understanding your personality, like what you are really like at your core, helps you work with yourself to make those changes instead of fighting against yourself and getting stuck.
Mm, yeah. You know, it's part of a journey to self-awareness. It's kind of funny how little we know about ourselves, even though we're the only ones that have been with us our whole lives. No one else has been there the whole time, but we still don't know that much about ourselves. And it's this journey to understand deeply who we really are and realize that that journey won't ever really end. And then in that self-awareness, you can learn to be more conscientious, like knowing how to respond instead of react, for instance, like what's going to make you upset. And then I know I'm going to get upset when, you know, X, Y, and Z happens in my life where I encounter, you know, this, that, and the other that threatens me. And instead of flying off the handle or getting fearful, I'm going to do this because I know that that's not a real threat or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you'd only be able to do that if you would have thought about it in the first place, practiced, you know, meditated on that in some fashion, or decided in your mind ahead of time as a choice, I plan on not doing that again. You know, it really is a whole different way of interacting in life, interacting with yourself in life, and interacting with other people. And that's why I think the pursuit of knowing yourself better and knowing how you interact with other people is never a vain pursuit or a worthless one, because you're going to be with yourself your whole life. So you might as well have it work out in the most optimal way possible.
Agreed.
So as you've done this work and this project, I'm sure you've deepened your own resources, you've deepened your own experiential knowledge. And what relationship do you think has fared the best?
Ooh, you know, it's funny. In the course of writing this book, it's always seemed to be the relationship most affected by whatever framework I was looking at the time. Just to avoid throwing my loved ones into the spotlight, I will say just the way I manage myself has changed significantly. And that's because, I mean, that's in spite of the fact that I already knew a lot about this stuff, but really shining what was sometimes a very painful spotlight, especially in that Enneagram chapter. Now nobody's going to read it. Everybody's going to want to be terrified. has really been, I mean, it's not always been pleasant, but it's really been illuminating, like in the best sense, to see how I tend to sabotage myself in ways that I was not even aware of before, because of the ways I'm inclined to act without a little guidance from that other part of my brain. I keep thinking of this book by David Eagleman. He's a neuroscientist. I know you love neuroscientists, Lisa. But he wrote this book about how we think about ourselves. And he says, like, when we're telling ourselves, you know, like when one part of our brain talks to the other, what's really happening there? Because it's all us. So I thought about him a lot in the course of this personality research, but like the Enneagram has helped one part of my brain tell the other, like, Anne, do you see what you're doing there? That is not good. And you should do this instead. And when part of me listens to the other part of me talking to me, things do go much better. But before I really dove really, really deep into the waters of these personality frameworks, I didn't perceive what was actually happening in those situations. And I'm so glad I see it now, even though it was painful at first, because it's only when you understand what's happening that you can actually do something about it.
It's really interesting to see that, you know, each number, whichever one you are, there's a really dark shadow side. And you will, if things are stressful or you haven't dealt with your stuff and you're unhealthy in some manner of, you have some woundedness or you have something going on, which pretty much everybody has, if not now, sometime. Something's going to happen that day or that week or sometime. And everybody's going to have their real tough points of struggle. That's what is so interesting to me, is that it will pinpoint, the Enneagram will pinpoint those the darker nature, if you will, or the real unhealthy behaviors that can come out. And to be able to look at that and be like, yeah, I see that. That is me. And then to be able to see there are the other side of it too, that when things are going well, this is good, this is good, this is good. And you can work down the line and say, well, these are the assets I have when things are going well. It's a motivation for you to see yourself better, to, in a sense, get to a healthier spot or deal with some of the things that you haven't seen before. And I thought it was really encouraging, because it's like, oh, they're already listed. Like, these are known quantities. Oh, good. They're out there. Like, if you didn't even know, it would be traumatizing. But the fact that, oh, I'm coming on my list here. This is my list. Okay, I can work with this. But it is hard to see the ugly parts of yourself. You have to be very brave and courageous through it, because to think that, to admit to yourself that this is the way I can be when I'm not my best, but you want to think of yourself as, you know, I'm a pretty good person. Mm-hmm. It can be very traumatizing. Mm-hmm. In your research, did you find that there were disciplines or spiritual practices or ways of becoming more self-aware that were part of those books, or is that going to have to be your second book?
when you get into the different systems, each definitely has its own clues for what do I pay attention to first find out my type. And the Enneagram, especially because it has such a rich history of being used as a tool for spiritual formation, has a more explicit system for using it as a tool for growth. like what kinds of questions to ask yourself and what to pay attention to and what steps you should take next, depending on where you are.
Yeah. Well, that is really a useful tool then. It's not just kind of like, the Cosmo test in the magazine, like, you know, oh, let's just check this out. But it's actually like, if you want to actually improve your life and and make it easier for the people around you too, then there are steps you can do. Do you have any resources this is a little bit off the top of your head, but for someone who'd want to get Enneagram information, besides, there's a good website, but do you know any books?
Yeah. After reading the book, if people want to after reading people, which I think is a great primer, if people want to know more, I do make this Reading People has a healthy recommended resources section for next steps, because there's so much information out there and not all of it is stellar, to put it gently. But you mentioned that you weren't sure about your type, and my favorite resource for strictly determining your type is a book called The Essential Enneagram, because of they have a research statistics-based test that they've used for years, and they walk you through step by step how to find your type. And it's not just one test, like it's multi-step, and each step gives you, it's almost like choose your own adventure. Each step says, if you're not right, like if you're not actually a four, then our research shows that you're most likely to be a seven or a two. And those types that I just rattled off, like those don't actually go together. That would be the actual situation. But it does say, like, okay, people who took our test, some types, 50% of the time, people got it right the first time. For some types, it's more like 88, but there's a wide range. But they say, this is the percent chance you went wrong and you are likely to be this type, or that type instead. And so then you can flip pages and look through all the descriptions and determine your type through a process, not just clicking 20 buttons on a website and getting like a result spit out at you. And you're thinking like, how did they even do that? Why do they know? What did I say that made me get that result? Like the self-test in the Essential Enneagram, which is many pages long. I mean, maybe 20 or 30. We're not talking about like two. Does explain all the reasoning in a way that's really helpful if you're trying to type yourself.
Well, this has been really fun. I do want you to come back on the show where we can talk maybe in a little more, not in a different kind of depth, I guess I should say, because you're a lot of fun to talk to, and I feel like we're just getting warmed up. So,
well, it's mutual. Thank you for having me.
Now, do you have any final words of wisdom or let everybody know where to find you?
Sure. Final would be, it's not always pleasant to dive into your personality frameworks, but some of these really are a lot of fun. So don't let all the scary stuff about the Enneagram turn you off. But I would just say, like, it can be hard, but it's worth it. And if you can just get one quick hit where you like open up a book about personality and you can read one true thing about yourself or someone you love and put it into action like that day, you'll be hooked. And that really is possible with all these personality frameworks. And online, you can find me at annbogle.com, which has links to everything. Or at my blog, modernmrsdarcy.com, at my podcast on iTunes. It's What Should I Read Next? You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find my book, Reading People, How Seeing the World Through the Lens of Personality Changes Everything, wherever you buy new books, like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or IndieBound.
That's really good. Thank you so much, Anne. And I agree completely. Once you... it's like getting a cheat code for a game or something. When you get a little tidbit that can give you an insight into somebody, how somebody thinks or how you think that you haven't realized it, it's a really huge step ahead, like a huge advantage that you didn't, you wish you had known, before. Like if I had known this 10 years ago, and it's fascinating to delve into, the deeper sides of ourselves and the hidden sides of ourselves. So this has been really enlightening, and I appreciate that you would come on.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you've listened to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website, that's what show notes are for. I've created an all-access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes, too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you.